This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper in Chicago. Wind-driven rain as Tropical Storm Harold hits South Texas. KHOU-TV's Matt Doherty.
We're in downtown Corpus Christi. Tropical Storm Harold made landfall in North Padre Island. We're about 300 yards from the beach. As you get closer, you can see the tide rising and those waves. Back here, we're not seeing a whole lot of flooding in Corpus Christi. What we are seeing is a whole lot of tree damage.
And at least 9,000 customers without power. Tropical Storm Hillary cleanup is underway in Southern California, where some are digging out of several inches of mud. Excessive heat hits millions of people from Minnesota to Florida. CBS's Roxana Saberi is in Chicago.
Conditions here could get dangerous, especially for schools without adequate air conditioning. Some are starting late or moving to remote learning.
It makes it a hard environment for the kids to learn in.
In Kansas City, feels like temperatures soared to 116, and in Minneapolis, 113.
Hawaiians face a long recovery from the devastating wildfires that struck Maui 2 weeks ago. Pentagon spokesperson General Patrick Ryder says the U.S. military is working with FEMA and state officials.
The U.S. Army's 25th Infantry Division Heavy Expanded Mobility Tactical Truck Fuelers began fuel distribution operations yesterday, providing approximately 1,500 gallons of fuel daily in support of 18 U.S. Army Corps of Engineer generators.
At least 115 people are confirmed dead in Maui and over 800 are missing. Whether Texas can continue to use border buoys in the Rio Grande as part of its border security effort is now in the hands of a federal judge. Lawyers for the Justice Department faced off against the state of Texas in federal court. Reporter Chris Fox in Austin.
The DOJ argued the buoy barriers are not only illegal and pose a serious risk to public safety, but they'd also drifted into the Mexican side of the Rio Grande. Texas Governor Greg Abbott says the state has the sovereign right to defend its borders, and on Monday he added Texas had repositioned the buoys.
Out of an abundance of caution, Texas went back and moved the buoys into a location where it is clear that they are on the United States side, not on the Mexico side.
U.S. District Judge David Ezra ordered both sides to submit closing arguments by Friday. Chris Fox for CBS News, Austin.
The Teamsters say its 340,000 members at UPS have approved a new contract. UPS workers will get across-the-board raises of $2.75 an hour, and some workers are getting larger raises. And as Cornell University labor expert Arthur Wheaton points out,
some important changes like Martin Luther King Jr. holiday, no forced overtime on your scheduled days off.
UPS also agrees to buy only air-conditioned vans beginning next year. This is CBS News.
Hire with minimal effort and max speed with Indeed. Their hiring solution platform helps you attract, interview, and hire candidates efficiently. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
For Civic Media News, I'm James Kelly. Congressman Derek Van Orden of Wisconsin's 3rd District and his wife Sarah Jane announced the passing of their oldest daughter, Sydney Marie Martinez, after a year of battling a very aggressive form of cancer. Van Orden shared that his daughter died peacefully, surrounded by family members, and is survived by her husband, daughter, and 2 sons. Due to the forecasted heat index, Eau Claire Transit is waiving fare requirements for passengers today and tomorrow. They announced passengers will be able to reach their destination in an air-conditioned bus instead of risking heat-related health conditions without concern of the cost. Heat indexes across Wisconsin are expected to reach over 100 degrees this week, and residents are urged to take extra caution to avoid heat-related issues. For Civic Media News, I'm James Kelly.
Call your local Buck Tussle rep today to find out how you can get free internet service. For Wapaka, Washera, Outagamie, Winnebago, Marquette, and Green Lake counties, call Kate at 920-401-5470. For Adams and Sauk counties, call Josh at 608-322-2190. For Columbia, Dodge, and Fond du Lac counties, call Bill at 920-602-7202. For Calumet and Brown counties, call Scott at 920-530-1311. 1.
Radio keeps your community informed, entertained, and connected. It's what we're all about at the Civic Media Network of local radio stations.
We're having fun and moving fast to preserve hometown radio across Wisconsin.
This includes a commitment to news.
Now we want to invite you to join Civic Media's exclusive Facebook group, Wisconsin Breaking News. It's a place to share your community's news and chat with others from across the state about it.
Join the Facebook group, Wisconsin Breaking News, today. It's the perfect companion to your local Civic Media radio station. As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry.
And apparently, Maggie Dawn, Fig Newton lover of the Maggie Dawn Show.
I was so offended, Jane. You know how much I love and admire you. You're like my freaking radio hero. And then to hear you bash my Newton.
It's still bad.
You want the cakey part cakey. You want the jammy part jammy. That is like bringing me back.
As Goes Wisconsin with host Kristen Bry. Weekdays 10 till noon on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
We've all felt left out. And for people who move to this country, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
It's What's on Tap for the Chippewa Valley. 93.5 The Tap.
I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
You know, we've never had combination of record warm oceans plus very strong developing El Nino event in recorded history.
Hurricane Hilary makes history as new storms brew in the record hot Atlantic. Panama Canal crippled by severe drought. Plus, Ecuador votes to protect the Amazon rainforest and keep oil in the ground.
Keep it in the ground. All of those stories and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
And it was only a few days ago before we all walked into one of the most significant weather events of our lives.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about, lots of Trump news, lots of trial news, lots of breaking news. For instance, the director of information technology at Mar-a-Lago evidently changed lawyers and then changed his tune. We find out today, and this is a huge story, because the bigger part of this is how many Trump lawyers does it take to get somebody to lie? How many Trump lawyers does it take to get you to make up and toe the company line? And then when you get another lawyer, they tell you to tell the truth. Going to be interesting to see how this plays out. Going to be interesting, because here's the thing. This guy's saying, well, you know, when I said that we didn't try and erase videos to cover up the classified stuff, well, that wasn't really true. Yeah. So lots of that, lots of fun, lots of entertainment, some good stuff on the children's debate that's going to happen on Wednesday. Which you got to go, why are you bothering? But here's the thing. And with all of the insanity, today was an interesting day for me in another way. And this is where I've been all day. It's been kind of I've been kind of down all day. Because today, you know, the kids' first day back to school. My youngest, it's her first day of high school. My son, his last year. He's a senior already. I mean, just my little buddy is now growing up. And, you know, we did like we do every year. We got up early, you know. Well, I should say my wife does, as she does every year. Got up early, took pictures. You know, the ritual of the first day. Going to get the good start, the breakfast, all that stuff. You know, get back into the swing of things. And I was home, and it was one of these things where, you know, first day of school, my son wants to ride his new motorcycle to school. So I'm following him as he's riding his new motorcycle. And my mind, you know, I couldn't stop thinking about the gravity of the moment.
that, you know, this is the next step in him becoming an adult and, you know, becoming a man and, you know, all that stuff that fathers go through. And, you know, it's, I started thinking about my own life. And, you know, on this day of, you know, it's, you know, he's talking about being uncertain, and there's a lot of uncertainty out there. And I remember me, you know, facing that same kind of uncertainty, but certain that, you know, hard work mattered, certain that I was going to be okay, certain that, you know, look, I was a good athlete. And hard work paid off. It paid off on the court, paid off on the field, the diamond, the rink, whatever. The harder you worked, the better opportunities you had. And if it worked, you know, in that arena, had to work in life. And to be honest, and I'll be completely frank, hard work has paid off. There's something to that, along with luck and good fortune and making reasonably decent, somewhat good decisions. I've done better than I could have ever imagined as a young child. I've led a life that I, you know, as a 10-year-old growing up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland, I've lived a life could have never imagined. And I was thinking about him. So as I'm following him to school on his motorcycle, and I know the feeling he's got, just this pride, this is, look at my pride and joy, Joe Cool riding into school. I get it. I just got this sense of dread of what the future holds for him after this year. And of course, you know, his older sister who graduated during the pandemic and his younger one who's, you know, she's going to graduate in a couple of years, what their future is going to look like. And, you know, again, I come back to this, that, you know, we had kind of a handle of what the future was going to look like. You know, it was the mid-80s. I graduated in 1985. So it was, you know, the economy was kind of in turmoil. We were deindustrializing. There were jobs being lost, but still you had a sense that there was still, you know, decent union jobs out there. There were still opportunities out there. And no one was predicting the end of life as we know it. As we're looking at the world that we're in now with all this AI and the robotics and all of this stuff. And I'm trying to figure out, you know, how do we direct, you know, where the kids go? How do we help them? And like we talked yesterday with Jessica McCabe from Alabama, the woman who made the viral TikTok video, you know, saying the same things. You know, what do we tell the kids? Because it's not the same world we grew up in. Even though you listen to older people, well, you know, I did it. I pulled myself up. Not in this environment. Not with the kind of uncertain future that these kids are walking into and the massive debt that we saddle them with. Because, hey, if you gotta get that college degree, if you want to get the golden ticket into the middle class, gotta have skin in the game. And I just, my mind was just stuck in this rotating kind of barrage of bad policy decisions over the last 40 years. And every bit of just every time we privatized something that we used to do for ourselves, every time corporate America got another tax break or deregulated, or every time politicians promised us the world, the sun, the moon, and then delivered us a big steaming pile of you know what. And my frustration just kind of today kind of built into this anger that I know a lot of parents feel. And I usually, it comes at the end of the year because now you got to go, well, what are we doing now? So my mind is in the planning, you know, how do I help him? How do we navigate this year? So it's a good year, because your senior year is supposed to be, you know, your best year of school. And yet after school, when we went and I told him, I'm going to treat you like a second grader today. We're going to go for ice cream. So we got on the motorcycles and we drove for a couple hours and just to kind of unwind. And as we're talking, you know, he's like, you know, all this technology and this technology, and we had to sign this form saying we won't use AI, or it'd be like plagiarism. And he's just going through all this stuff that I didn't identify with. And again, that uncertainty of what direction is he going to be able to take? And not just him, but his entire class and, his generation. And my mind comes back to politics. It all comes back to politics. When people go, why are you such a, why is everything in your world? Because that's what it is. Government decides who gets what. And for the longest time, it's been deciding that working people, well, not. Students, certainly not. People who need help, not. The well-to-do, the well-heeled, the well-connected, the well-organized up at the top, well, they're fine. And they will be fine. It comes back to us taking off the red hats and the blue hats and getting back to work, to building this country, this economy. And this is why, again, say what you want about Joe Biden. I like the fact that we're making the turn off the neoliberal path, that we're making the turn and going in a direction that's going to be helpful for my kids' generation. The idea that we're building stuff, because one of the things that I'm pushing him towards is getting into the building trades. The one thing that you're not going to be able to do away with right now is building stuff. And there's going to be a lot of things that need to be built. So over the next 20 years, as all of these investments happen, he's going to be able to have something of a career. And that's a good thing. If he makes good decisions, saves his money. I mean, he's had an IRA since he's been 15, like all the kids. Maybe he's going to be okay. But I just kept coming back to, policy-wise, there's one party that not helping at all. And Democrats don't have the muster. They don't have the power to move an agenda that's going to be helpful quick enough. For instance, I look at the college student loan stuff. We've been talking about student loan reform, debt forgiveness, whatever you want to call it, for years now. This isn't just a Biden thing. This was going on during the Obama years as well. How do you unsaddle a generation with massive debt? Now, today, of course, the Biden administration launched a new initiative, an income-driven student loan program, because very soon those loan payments have to begin. So this is a way of maybe easing back into it. And I've said from the beginning, I think the right path on this has always been, get this out of the hands of the profiteers and the privateers, make this a public good, buy up the loans with real cheap dollars, and then charge people a minuscule interest rate. You borrowed $10,000, you pay $10,000 back. None of this stuff that you end up with a lifetime of debt that you never get out from under. But at least Biden's trying. And this is where today I came back, and I'm a little more hopeful than I started the day, because I'm hoping his generation, I'm hoping they get it. I'm hoping young people start to vote in ways that I'm told that they are, but I don't see yet. I'm hoping people get out and say, look, we should have an economy that works for everyone, not just the well-connected and the well-heeled and the well-lobbied, but for average, everyday working people. And this is where my mind's at. So I want to hear your thoughts. Any of the same kind of frustrations, any of the same kind of like, I come back, the word I got is dread. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, your thoughts. Stick around and listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, again, I come back to this, that... this feeling of of, you know, what do we do and how do we move forward? That to me is what we should be focused on. How do we make opportunities for the next generation better than we had? I mean, that was the American dream, wasn't it? You work hard, play by the rules, you get ahead, and every generation does a little bit better than the last one. When did we screw that up? That's my question. Let's go to the phones. Got Kurt in Akron on line one. Kurt, how you doing?
Hey, good evening, Rick. And hey, I graduated 10 years after you, so even I felt like I had the world by the you-know-what at that time, too. And that was 10 years after the trickle-down theory took place. But what I was going to say is we need to start investing in people, and I'm a prime example of that, where I was born with a disability. And my mom and dad, you know, my dad had a union job, as you know, and he could afford to send me to school. But they thought, well, why don't you see what the Bureau of Services for the Visually Impaired in Stark County, Ohio, can do for you, because we live in Stark County. I had a caseworker come, and they sat with me. And they said, now, Kurt, we're not going to do anything until we have a long-term plan of what you want to do for success. And then you have to maintain at least a 2.0 GPA in order for this to happen. Got my schooling paid for because my community invested in me to go to Kent State University. And as a result, I was able to graduate with a 3.0 cumulative. And I got a job the day I graduated from college, and I've been paying taxes ever since. That's how you do it.
No, that's the right thing. I mean, that's the thing we should be doing. And not just with one group or another, but with everyone who can
Everybody.
Go through and do the work. I mean, we should be investing in people so that they don't. I listen to my right-wing friends talk all the time about, you know, all these people on the dole, on welfare. You want to get people off that? Give them opportunity. Give them the jobs that everyone I knew as a kid growing up on welfare desperately, desperately wanted.
You invest. That's what you do. You invest in people, and that's how you do it.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. Appreciate the thoughts, though, Kurt. Thanks, man.
Yep. Thank you.
No, I mean, this is, duh. This should be common sense. Should be common sense, without question. Let's quick go to the phones. We've got Bob in Silicon Valley on line two. Bob, how are you?
Oh, pretty good. What I'm hoping is that along the way, you and your wife convinced your kids that you're never really done learning. That you, in my field, things changed several times, and by taking weekend classes and night classes and reading the trade magazines regularly, that's how I kept up.
Yeah.
And so I was pretty much on top of the change as it happened. But otherwise, if you think, hey, I'm done with school and now I can just go to work and that's it, you can become obsolete.
No, you're absolutely right. And this is why I'm pushing my son toward, he doesn't really want to go to college right after school. He eventually wants to be an engineer. But he said he wants to get some real world experience. And I got to give him credit for having a little maturity and thinking, hey, I want to go work a little bit, get some world experience, and then go back. And look, I think the building trades is a perfect place because they do exactly what you're saying. Constant continuing education, constant keeping up with the new trends and you know, new information. So I think for me anyway, I'm pushing him in that direction. And I think this is the right thing for him in this moment.
Yeah, well, say I'm glad you're doing that. You say this is the thing I think some parents don't realize is that you really have to convince your kids that school is never ever over, that you're always learning, and that's how you stay relevant.
No, you're absolutely right. Look, I went back to school. I went back to school in my 30s, and then got a master's degree and all that stuff. Didn't do me any good. But I still went back because it was one of those things I promised my mother, that I was going to be the first to graduate from college in our family. And I went and I kept that promise, even if it took me a lot of years.
Well, I you know, that's a reason to be proud, to say I made it.
Yeah.
But you understand, too, just because you had the degree doesn't mean you stopped and said, I'm done now. I don't need to crack any books anymore.
No, every day is a learning experience.
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you,
anyway,
Bob.
Thank you, Rick.
Appreciate it. Good stuff. No, I mean, that's an important point Bob makes there, that you never stop learning. You never stop upgrading your skills. You never stop because you can be left behind. I'm right there with him. Let's go to CJ in Madison. CJ, how are you?
Thanks for taking my call, Rick.
Appreciate What's on your mind?
Well, I disagree with you on the student loan forgiveness.
Okay.
It's unconstitutional. And why should someone who decided not to go to school have to pay for someone else who did?
I've heard all those arguments.
It's going to raise the tuition costs. And the mere fact that it doesn't teach people, we don't teach our kids finance,
You lost me, CJ, already. You know, this is one of those things that drives me nuts. What choice did the kids most kids have? I was sold. I don't know how old you are, but I was told coming out of high school, 1985, that the only chance that you've got to get into the middle class is to go to college. It's the only path. There's no more. We're deindustrializing. Those union jobs are gone. All those factory jobs are gone. Those opportunities gone. Your only chance, go to college, take on this debt. Fortunately, I didn't get saddled with a lifetime of debt. But I look at my wife's nieces and nephews and the kind of screw job that's happened to them because they were told, hey, this is your only path. The only way you're getting into the middle class is take on this debt and get this job because that's the only way this employer is going to hire you. So to hear you say, well, we're not teaching them things. it really ticks me off, well, CJ. I got to be honest.
I worked in the trades for 30 plus years, so I'm doing exactly what you're encouraging your son to do. I made great money. I put in a lot of hours. I supported my family, but there is a difference between public and private. And the mere fact that the trades are a great place,
yep.
But the kids can't even read a tape measure today, Rick.
Yeah, that
they're graduating without able to read a tape measure, so it's a sad fact.
I agree
can't
with you.
Read
absolutely
they
with
can't
you.
Can't do math. Well, we're failing our kids in the public school system, so why not give parents a choice to take that money and send their kids where they can learn to read a tape measure?
I think we've moved our education system in a direction with different ideals, away from building and away from the things that we grew up with. But here's the thing. Let me ask you a simple question. Had you wanted to go to the University of Wisconsin at Madison 30-some years ago, if you had the grades to get in and the want to get in and all of that, what would it have cost you 30-some years ago? And then what would it cost today?
Well, you're saying I was accepted into the University of Minnesota.
Okay.
For to be a architect. Okay. And I decided not to because I wanted to play basketball. It was the stupidest decision I ever made. But I made a great career. I supported my family, and it would have cost me about a third of what it costs today.
And that's the problem.
But CJ, every man, woman, and child owes $95,000 right now, Rick. How much more are you going to saddle your grandkids with? $95,000 a baby born today owes the federal government.
Of which most is held by American citizens.
Santa Claus said this student loan forgiveness is all about buying votes. That's what it is.
Well, I see it differently, but I appreciate the call, CJ. Thanks so much. No, I mean, for me, it's not about buying votes. It's about unburdening a generation that we saddled with massive debt that we shouldn't have. Because of bad policy, we screwed them over. Got it. Let's go to Alice on line three. Alice, how are you?
Totally insane at this point. So, I am a college graduate, the very first one in my family. I graduated from I guess you would call it an elite religious college. It's a university now. I could have bought a brand new house with the amount of money that I took out, and which I finally just paid off 10 years ago. Yes, we need student loan forgiveness because I would prefer to spend my money on having an educated populace instead of donating the money to billionaires. And as for not being able to read a ruler, honey, I've got 12 years of high school graduate, 5 years of college, And when it comes to reading a roll, I go things like, it's 2.5 inches and 2 hoochies past the 3/4 mark. So saying that, because apparently I missed it all in school every freaking year. So you can't go on that either. And I'm tired of the right wing and their stupidity. But, you know, what are you going to do when you listen to Fox News and read all the right wing nonsense on Facebook? I guess you're just stupid. But have a good evening, Rick.
Thanks, Alice. Appreciate it. No, for me, it's simple. I don't think we do debt forgiveness, and I've said this before. My position has always been very clear. If you took out $10,000, you got to pay $10,000 back. That's always been my position. I don't think the administration's going to take me up on this. But the fact that we're saddling a generation with the kind of debt that we are, and the interest rates, you know, like I said, you know, my wife's nieces and nephews have, you know, massive debt in the private sector, paying, you know, 9-11% interest on just the opportunity to get into the middle class. We should be doing better than that, because we did better for past generations. So it's interesting that past generations look say now and go, well, no, not for you. It's okay for me, not for you. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1934. That was the day striking Teamsters in Minneapolis defied martial law. They stopped scab trucks, forcing the release of their strike leaders. Armed with bayonets and machine guns, the National Guard had patrolled the streets for nearly a week. They seized scores of strikers and union leaders and threw them into military stockades. Drivers were outraged. They defied Governor Olson and Major General Walsh, who, on behalf of the Citizens Alliance and trucking bosses, were determined to break the strike. Soon after strikers were imprisoned, drivers began chasing scab trucks across the city. Multiple reports poured in of picketers forcing trucks to stop. Some unloaded their cargo onto bridges. Others chased, captured, and damaged the scab trucks. Strikers ripped ignition wires out, forced scabs from the wheel, and then disappeared before police and the National Guard could arrive to retaliate. In just 3 hours, strikers had overturned nearly 70 trucks. Unable to stop the superior force of striking drivers, Bill Brown, Vincent, and Miles Dunn were ordered unconditionally released from the military stockades. Now, employers, the governor, and other strike-breaking agencies were eager to propose peace to federal mediators. But they proposed to scrap the terms of their earlier May agreement. In response, the leaders of Local 574 issued a general strike call. In it, they asked, quote, "Is there one man so blind as not to see that if 574 is allowed to go down to defeat under the brutal hammering of military despotism, the whole labor movement of the city will have been dealt a mortal blow? Union men, brothers, sisters, fellow workers, what are you going to do about it? We appeal to you for solidarity."
Labor History in 2, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Last week, T-Mobile, my cell phone provider, pinged me with a rude message. "Henceforth, we will screw you out of an extra $5 a month." What? Had I done something wrong? No. Would I be getting some added benefit for my $5? No. It seems that T-Mobile bean counters have just arbitrarily decided that we customers who use credit cards to pay our phone bills online must pay an extra fiver each month as a payment processing fee. Yes, we're to pay them to take our money. Bonnie and Clyde were not that brazen. You can avoid the add-on if you give your bank account number to T-Mobile, allowing it and who knows who else to have direct access to your personal stash of cash. No. Tut-tut, say the T-Mobilers. Your private info is perfectly secure with us. Do they think we have sucker wrappers around our heads? Just 8 months ago, their security system let thieves swipe the personal data of 37 million customers, including names, account numbers, addresses, phone numbers, and birth dates. Well, sniff free market ideologues, just switch to a competitor. But AT&T, Verizon, etc. have all adopted the exact same thieving give-us-your-bank-account scheme. Phone service today is a shared monopoly, not a free market, and it's now copycatting airlines, banks, and other monopolistic profiteers that constantly fabricate add-ons and pricing gimmicks to gouge consumers. This is Jim Hightower saying, T-Mobile rose to telecom prominence a decade ago by attacking its rivals for overcharging and abusing consumers. It ran ads publicly demanding that AT&T and others stop their greedy practices, quote, because it's the right thing to do. But now that it's a monopolistic giant, T-Mobile's new line is that might makes right. So it has joined the industry's consumer abuse greed game.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, some good news I came across today, and I'm hoping this is right. I'm hoping we're finally going to start cracking down on the Chinese dumping solar panels here into the U.S. and maybe build our own solar panels. So, like I've been saying for years, domestic production for domestic consumption. We build it here, we use it here, we buy it here, we create the jobs here. It sounds like a great idea to me. So when I saw Sherrod Brown say it's official, Chinese-made solar panels have been cheating American trade laws for almost a decade, Ohio solar manufacturers and workers are poised to lead this industry. He says, I'll never stop fighting for a level playing field so they can compete. Why I love Sherrod Brown, and here to share some thoughts on, well, are we actually going to take them on, or is this window dressing? I've asked our good friend Scott Paul to come talk with us. Scott is the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, AmericanManufacturing.org, the website, if you want to check out the work that they do. Scott, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick, great to be with you. So I agree with you on Sherrod Brown, man. Great guy.
What am I getting out of this? Are we finally going to take on this dumping? Are we finally going to take this cheating on?
Yeah. Well, the answer is eventually. All right. You know, and this is the frustrating thing. So this solar saga has played out over a long time. There were some tariffs that were put into place back in the Obama administration directly on China, and then the Trump administration as well. And then these companies that make the solar panels in China figured a way around. They said, well, we're going to send some of the stuff to Malaysia, to Vietnam, to some other countries to what is called circumvent those tariffs. And so this case that Sherrod Brown's talking about was called a circumvention case designed to crack down on these pass-through Chinese imports that are now coming through countries like Vietnam and Malaysia. And the Commerce Department said, yes, indeed, this is happening with very few exceptions. And there will be tariffs, in some case, big tariffs, put into place. The hitch is this, that the Biden administration announced last year a moratorium on new tariffs on solar until basically the middle of next year, because all the solar developers were saying there's not enough production in the United States of America and the market will dry up. So please let us have this last fix of imports.
I like the way you put that.
This last fix of imports before we actually have to buy American. And there's big incentives to do that. But there's a lot to unpack here. But that's the essence of the case, right?
I mean, you know, the capacity question is a very real one. And it comes back to this, you know, had we not had all of the obstruction and all of the attacks on the attempt of the Obama administration to get us some production domestically, I don't know that maybe we not in this position.
Yeah, that's 100% right. And what we've seen, I think, is that even with this deferred action and the incentives in the Inflation Reduction Act, the clean energy incentives, and there's big ones, there's something called Section 45X, which basically covers a lot of the cost of capital of building a new solar factory in the United States. Okay, so this has led a bunch of companies, including some of the companies that had been making them in China or these other countries, to say, we're going to locate production in the United States of America. And we've seen announcements in Ohio, and we've seen them in Texas, and we've seen them in Georgia, and we've seen them on the West Coast, and we've seen them, I think, even in New York. But there's been a lot of solar plant announcements that have come about. And so these factories are trying to scale up. And I will say many of them are trying to do it the right way by having an ethical domestic supply chain from start to finish, because there's still a lot of unanswered questions, because polysilicon, one of the major ingredients basically that goes into solar manufacturing, by and large comes from Xinjiang or China. Wafers, which are, you know, part of the solar manufacturing process that can be turned into solar modules, they slip through this trade enforcement thing. And so we still might have an issue with them. And so this hasn't solved the problem, but at least we're stepping in the right direction. And we are building that capacity in the United States. Right. I personally think the Biden administration should speed up the end of that moratorium. I mean, I suppose I have mixed feelings about the logic of all of this, but I do think that the capacity in the United States is scaling up dramatically, and we can start, you know, turning up the volume on those tariffs in a way before the middle of the next year. And I think that will help to boost solar manufacturing in the United States even further than it is right now.
What do you say to the person? Because I know this is one of the industry talking points. Well, we're just not scaling up fast enough because we don't have the workers to build the new facilities. We would love to do all those wonderful things that you're talking about, Mr. Paul. But, you know, we just don't have the ability, because all of the other building is happening. Because I don't know if you've noticed, we're in the middle of a manufacturing boom. Lots of jobs being created, lots of facilities being built, lots of people working, doing that kind of stuff.
Yeah. You're right. There is a lot of this, and there is a help wanted sign out every construction site, every manufacturing facility. They have one of these. But the difference is, once people discover these opportunities, and as you know, Rick, these jobs need a little more training than working in fast food. And I say that with respect, because I started in a Dairy Queen, right? And you did have to have a little bit of training, but it was about a day, as opposed to maybe complete a welding course or an electrician's course or something like that. This is going to take a little longer. And so I think that with the wages in manufacturing, which are higher than they are in the service sector, that you'll be able to scale this stuff up. I don't think there's any question about that. But the industry, and this is the interesting thing, the industry association, I'm just going to admit I don't like them at all. You know, they said that they questioned the validity even of this decision, right? They were saying, well, you know, this is just, this circumvention is just, it was wrong to put these tariffs on, even if they're going to be deferred. And so that's the thing that burns me, because they know exactly what's happening here, is that these solar installers and developers were making some serious bank, some real margins, because they were bringing in this dump product and they had it. And now they're getting called on it. Right, as you should. If you are cheating, if you're bringing in products that are subsidized or dumped at the expense or harm of American industry, then you got to punish that somehow. And that's what's happening here. And so the idea that there wouldn't be consequences to this, I think that's the thing that really annoys me about the industry's stance more than anything else. Because the workers, we will find them. They will be there. And we know this. Workers flock to good jobs. So, you know, if the plan is organized, there's a really good chance that they're going to be able to staff up in a hurry. If the plan is paying good wages, same thing. They're going to be able to staff up in a hurry.
No, and that's the important part of this. I mean, if we're going to be spending all this money, and this is where my mindset has always been, if we're going to be investing all of this money, all this resource, all of this into the new technologies, into a greener economy, we should be benefiting from that. It should not be something that the Chinese are getting. Now, the argument that I get most often is, well, you know, the Chinese can do it so much cheaper, so we can do so much more. What do you say to that?
Yeah, I think in the long run, that is a self-defeating argument for a couple of different reasons. We have depended on China for a lot of things, and how has that worked out for us as a country, right? With respect to medicine or a lot of other things. We've run into shortages, we've run into quality problems. Ultimately, you get what you pay for, okay? So that's number one. I think number two is that we have an issue with respect to supply chains and the ethics of those supply chains, and also compliance with the law. We have a law in place called the Uyghur Forced Labor Prevention Act, which basically says we're presuming goods that are coming from that region of China are made with forced or slave labor, because many of them are. And there's no way to really independently verify that they aren't, because you can't get access to those countries, to those factories. But we know, based on eyewitness accounts and other accounts, that the slave labor is happening. And so it is against the law, probably, to bring a lot of this stuff in. And so that's problematic, because those supply chains are horribly unethical. And then finally, you lose public support. I mean, the reason why all this stuff passed is because there was a Made in America component to it. And let's be honest here. I mean, I believe climate change is real. I want to make progress on it. Not everyone feels that way, particularly on, you know, in a lot of, you know, rural parts of the country. I'm just going to say it. But something that's very compelling is that, you know what? I'm for any American energy source, as long as it creates American jobs and is going to bring down the price of my electricity. And that's exactly what the solar incentives combined with the tariffs are going to do once we are fully scaled up in a couple of years here.
Now, I mean, for me, the idea, look, I'm with you. I agree climate change is real, something we do have to address. But even if you don't, the idea of moving away from, you know, dirty stuff, from, you know, stuff that we have to get from foreign countries, and just a way to get off the grid so that you could be somewhat independent. This is the weird thing for me. Conservatives always talk about, you know, being, you know, independent, getting away from government, getting away from, and yet the one of the ways that you could be completely energy independent is move towards solar, move towards geothermal, move towards every home in this country being built completely off the grid with the new technologies that would afford you the ability to do that.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And simply trading like made in China solar panels instead of like Middle Eastern oil still gets you in a geopolitical mess, just like we've seen with these tariffs, by the way, you know, because it limits your options. And if we are able to do that clean energy manufacturing in the United States, deploy it in the United States, it's ultimately, yes, going to help with respect to climate change, but it's also going to help with respect to jobs. And as you pointed out, Rick, with respect to energy independence, which is something that I think most Americans strongly, strongly support.
Yeah, it just seems weird that it's become a political red hat, blue hat issue when it should just be. I go back to when we put solar panels on our house. My son was, he was just a little, he was a couple years old when that happened. And he asked the simple question. Why aren't they everywhere? Why aren't they on the roof of the school or the Walmart or the supermarket? Why don't we have these everywhere, Dad? And I'm like, I don't know. I'm hoping we get there. But, you know, that was 2012?
Yeah. It's a, look, we're getting there. And I think that, again, the combination of these tariffs and the investments and the Made in America aspects of this, by every analysis, they have really pushed forward the implementation of renewable energy like solar panels and wind turbines. And they're increasing exponentially. I mean, if you look at any of the charts, and I'm sure you have, of this stuff, I mean, it's just like a, slope that goes straight up, you know, over the, since the Inflation Reduction Act. It's remarkable. And so we will, you know, you may not see a lot of them in the neighborhood necessarily, but you can bank on the fact that utilities are installing these. And yeah, there are big incentives for companies to install these in large spaces too. But they're being deployed rapidly all over the country. The energy mix is changing. I mean, I saw something that I thought was really ironic. Tulsa, one of the hearts of the American oil industry. In fact, their local baseball team is called the Drillers. Tulsa now gets 25% of its electricity through renewable sources, through solar and wind. And most people don't see that, except for it's coming in cheaper and it's renewable. Yeah. And so what's not to like about it?
And what's not to like? I'm right there with you. Finally, I got to get your thoughts on this Goldman Sachs report. Yeah. I know there's a manufacturing boom. I know we keep talking about it, but when Goldman Sachs says, you know, hey, Biden and his policies are going to create what, a quarter of a million jobs over the next 2 years. I can't say the Biden, I can't steal the Biden line, but this is kind of a BFD.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. When the investment banks are actually bullish on American manufacturing, you know, it must be real, I guess, something like that. So they were the first ones to escort American business offshore too. And so I think that they do see an opportunity. And I think that that's a pretty good number. That doesn't mean there's not going to be churn in other parts of the industry. And we know, particularly, not necessarily with respect to solar and wind, but overall within the energy sector, overall within the transportation sector, there are going to be adjustments because it's not the same process to make a combustion engine as it is an EV. They're just less parts in an electric vehicle, right? Less manufacturing. Same thing with respect to offshore drilling or wind turbines. It's just that the offshore drilling jobs right now pay very well. Some of them are unionized. There's a big union footprint in all of that. And so we need the same thing in renewables to make sure that there is that just transition. These are important issues we have to deal with, but I am bullish on the possibilities for American manufacturing, just like Goldman Sachs. And I don't say that very often.
Yeah, that's a sentence you, it doesn't come off your lips very easy. That's kind of hard to get out, isn't it? It's like when the Chamber of Commerce does something I agree with, it's really hard to let that out.
Yeah. Yeah. But it is the objective truth, which is awesome. And so no matter what, you know, some of the Fox News or the Republicans or what, I mean, it's happening. And if you look around, you can see it happening if you go to any part of the country right now. So it is real. It's happening. It is there. Yeah. And, and even the investment bankers see it for what it is.
Look, I saw Biden's infrastructure bill. I saw firsthand a lot of his projects working as I was driving home from Connecticut over the weekend. A lot of construction on the way home from Bridgeport to central Pennsylvania. But hey, long term, going to be good stuff. But Scott,
amen.
As always, I appreciate the time, the good news, and I'm glad it's good news. But I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Of course, Rick. Great to be with you tonight.
Our good friend Scott Paul. Make sure you check out their website, AmericanManufacturing.org. We'll get links out on social media how you can do that. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1980. That was the day that Joyce Miller became the first woman ever elected to the executive board of the AFL-CIO. In her 2012 obituary, the New York Times described Joyce's commitment to women's rights in the labor movement, writing, "Miss Miller saw union membership, collective bargaining, and labor contracts as the road to equality for working women, and she believed that women should be a part of union management to make sure that attention was paid to issues like equal opportunity, equal pay, parental leave, child care, health insurance, and discrimination in the workplace." Joyce grew up in Chicago, where she earned her master's degree in education from the University of Chicago. She first entered the labor movement as a worker at a gumball factory while attending college. After graduation, she became the education director for the Amalgamated Clothing Workers Union in Pittsburgh. She remained dedicated to union education for rank and file members. Joyce was a founding member of the Coalition of Labor Union Women, or CLU. She served as CLU's East Coast vice president, eventually being elected CLU's president in 1977, a position she would hold for 15 years. Under her leadership, CLU worked as a powerful voice for women's reproductive
reproductive rights, improving child care, and increasing the number of women in union leadership positions. In 1993, President Bill Clinton named Joyce Miller the executive director of the Glass Ceiling Commission. The purpose of the commission was to gather testimony about women's experience in the workplace and to draft a report of their findings. Of her career, Joyce said, "I came to the labor movement with stars in my eyes. I saw it as a vehicle for social change, and I never changed my mind." Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So, Donald Trump has evidently a universal, what is this, a universal basic tariff or something along this line is what they're putting forth? Universal baseline tariff is what they're working on. And this is one of those weird kind of moments where, you know, I think back to when he won in 2016. And I remember saying at the time, if he sticks to what he ran on, if he sticks to, hey, we're going to rebuild manufacturing, we're going to bring those union jobs back, we're going to rebuild our infrastructure. Because if you remember, he was talking about $3 trillion in infrastructure spending. $3 trillion. And if he had stuck to the trade deficit, he'd have stuck to that instead of all of the insanity and all the craziness and all the criming and all the, you know, the perfect phone calls and the nonsense. He would have been reelected hands down. He would have been, had he moved in the direction that Biden is now taking us, which again is what Bernie Sanders was moving us towards. Had he done that, he'd have been unbeatable. But here he is now, probably going to go to jail. But here's the thing. Evidently, they had a big powwow last week with Larry Kudlow, Brooke Rollins, and Stephen Moore and Newt Gingrich. Three of those people, you put them in a room together, nothing but bad ideas come out of it. And most of the problems we have today go back to their ideas. Just my thought. I guess we got Alice again? Alice! What's up?
Aren't you lucky you get me twice tonight?
Look at that.
But I called back because I've been wanting to tell you for 2 weeks, and I always forget once we hang up.
Uh-oh.
My friend and I were coming back from West Virginia 2 weeks ago, and we were coming the back way, and once we hit the Pennsylvania side, there is a power plant there, First Energy. And about 25 years ago, they put the power plant up, and they bought the land on both sides of the road for, I don't know, about 2 miles, 3 miles. When we were coming back, they were putting up solar panels, acres and acres of solar panels.
Yep.
So I forgot to tell you that. So I'm going to assume that they were getting some sort of government, funding to do that. So that's what I wanted to tell you.
No, I appreciate it, Alice. No, that's good stuff. No, I mean, the reality is this is what happens when you have a smart policy. When you say we're going to, as a matter of the country, this is where we're going to go, and we're going to incentivize it, which is why I'm not opposed to the idea of incentives. I've said for years, I want to have a really high tax rate, especially on rich people and on corporate America, and then we incentivize behavior that we want and need, you know, as we've done in the past, and, you know, successfully in some cases. Reagan forward, not so much. But this is one of these moments where you go, there's an opportunity here. There is an opportunity to do some smart stuff. The question is, will we? And this is where my problem, I keep coming back to this will we moment. Will we do what's in the best interest of the future of this country? For instance, there's a story right now, U.S. Steel, iconic U.S. Steel. Was the first billion-dollar corporation on this planet. In fact, it was one of the two corporations, them and Sohio, the big gas, Rockefeller and the gas, the big gas company. They were the reason for the antitrust laws because they were so big. And well, the story right now going on is that they're up on the chopping block. two companies, Cleveland-Cliff and this I'm not even sure how you say that. but you've got these two companies that are now going to be bidding for it. One owned by basically a hedge fund. The other one, as I understand, a good union company that wants to run it in a way that's going to, to keep jobs and do all of the things that we want to do. And it got me to thinking about, where we are in this moment, where for the last 40 years, what's happened is you see these iconic companies, who are still profitable, and they are,